Your Honors, this is not the run-of-the-mill withdrawal of a guilty plea case. The great majority of those cases that I've read that appeared in this court and were considered by this court, defendant pleads guilty, later gets his pre-sentence report back and sees a recommended range of punishment or talks to his jailhouse buddies and decides at some point that he's made a mistake and he'd like to start over. And in that case, the court invariably finds that under the seven Carr factors in U.S. versus Carr that he has not articulated a fair and just reason to withdraw his plea. That is not the case in this situation, Your Honor. I found one case in which this court found that the district court had abused its discretion in refusing to allow a defendant to withdraw his plea of guilty. That was U.S. versus McDonald in 2011. And our case, Your Honor, is exactly, or Your Honors, is exactly on point factually with U.S. versus McDonald. In McDonald, the defendant filed a motion to suppress evidence that was denied. He then later pled guilty when his lawyer told him that he would be allowed to appeal his denial of the motion to suppress evidence after he pled guilty. Clearly was incorrect. He, by pleading guilty, he waived all previous non-jurisdictional defects. So then he later did file a motion to withdraw his plea of guilty under the Carr factors and primarily under the sixth Carr factor, which is apparently to all cases that I've seen the most important, and that is that the plea of guilty was made involuntarily. And it was made involuntarily because it was based on ineffective assistance of counsel. That is a clearly held rule in this court, in this circuit. There was a long trail of deficient, inattentive, subpar performance by the first lawyer. I should clarify, there was the first retained lawyer who we are alleging committed ineffective assistance of counsel. Then there is a second lawyer appointed later to replace him. Yes, sir. No, he did not file any motions, did not file any challenges, showed up for the first rearrangement with a plea bargain agreement in hand that he had not discussed with the defendant, and in the 5 minutes after the defendants are brought into the courtroom, he wants to discuss the plea bargain agreement. He has to ask for an oral motion to continue. It's reset for a rearrangement. He comes back again, still has not been out to the jail to talk to Mr. Gardner about this proposed plea bargain agreement or about this motion to suppress evidence that Mr. Gardner wants. He has to ask for another oral motion for continuance. Rearrangement is continued again. He comes back for the third rearrangement. Now, 4 more weeks later, he still has not been out to the jail to talk to Mr. Gardner about the proposed plea bargain agreement or the motion to suppress evidence that Mr. Gardner wants. Mr. Gardner finally goes ahead and pleads guilty. The attorney shows up for the first sentencing hearing and has to again ask for an oral motion for continuance because he hasn't filed his objections to the pre-sentence report. And the judge grants that. And at that point is when the first retained lawyer tells Mr. Gardner, oh, by the way, I'm not going to be able to file that motion to suppress evidence after all. That's been waived. And that's when Mr. Gardner fires him and the court appoints a new attorney to take over. The new attorney and that's when the new attorney files the motion to withdraw the plea of guilty, and that is denied. Eventually, the new attorney files 6 additional objections to the pre-sentence report that were granted that the first retained attorney missed. So there's a long trail of inefficiency, inattentiveness from the first retained attorney, which culminates in this advising Mr. Gardner, we can file that motion to suppress evidence after you plead guilty, Your Honor. It appears to me, Your Honor, that's the biggest matter that weighs against Mr. Gardner. There was a 7-month delay. It did take the new appointed attorney some time to get up to speed, but it wouldn't have taken 7 months. I agree with that. But this court did find in the McDonald case in 2011 that the involuntary plea based on ineffective assistance even overcame a 9-month delay in the McDonald case. So we think there is has been a holding in this case and in the previous case that is a Yes, sir. I think what the court focused on in both of those cases was the ineffective assistance. In McDonald, the attorney in that case advised McDonald that he would have the right to appeal his motion to suppress evidence later. That was the ineffective assistance. In our case, the attorney advised Mr. Gardner that he could file the motion to suppress evidence after he pled guilty. That was the ineffective assistance. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That is the second ground that we raised, is that the district court erred in not holding an evidentiary hearing. And so...
You really can't go anywhere if you've been there.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. As a member of the federal defense bar, it's incomprehensible to me that a lawyer would advise a client, oh, you can go ahead and plead guilty today. I'm bringing you the proposed plea bargain agreement for the third time and haven't discussed it with you, but you can go ahead and plead guilty today and I'll file the motion to suppress later. It's incomprehensible that a lawyer would make a mistake of that magnitude. And so we think at the least, Your Honor, this court should send this case back with the order for the district court to have an evidentiary hearing on it. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I had spoken to the lawyer, the first retained attorney. He told me he did not tell Mr. Gardner that. Now, that's what he told an appellate lawyer snooping around. Whether he would say the same thing in front of a federal district judge under oath and penalty of perjury, I don't know what he would say, Your Honor. That's correct, Your Honor. Mr. Gardner pled guilty without signing that plea bargain agreement, so there was no formal. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And it went through the usual Rule 11 plea colloquy, and based on what Mr. Gardner had been told at the time, he did plead voluntarily. I mean, nobody had coerced him or forced him or paid him to plead guilty that day, that he pled guilty with the understanding his attorney would file a motion to suppress afterwards.
Yes, sir. He said he was satisfied with his representation.
He did, Your Honor. as an attorney looking back at it, I find his, the retained attorney's performance to be deficient. Mr. Gardner did not express any dissatisfaction. You get the maximum sentence, a statutory maximum of 240 months, Your Honor. There, yes, sir, well, as alleged in the motion, there is, Your Honor, and that was what was before the district court. The district court ruled summarily the day after the motion was filed and denied the motion to withdraw the plea of guilty the next day. I don't know what time, what day, which day that motion reached the district court's desk. I don't know if it reached it the day it was filed or the next day, which was the day he denied it. I don't know. I don't know how much time the district court spent in analyzing it and responding to it. I will say that at this time, the district court had been recently appointed, though I believe he had been a magistrate judge for a number of years earlier in his career, so it's not as if he were unfamiliar with federal criminal practice, that he was relatively new to the district court bench. But I should also say that I've appeared before him on multiple occasions, and I've always found the district court to be very fair and well-prepared and efficient, diligent. I don't think so, Your Honor. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
You know, a 20-minute hearing would save everybody a lot of time.
I don't think I'm going to have a problem filling my time, Your Honor, if that's what you're suggesting.
I'm talking about a 20-minute hearing before the district court would have saved everybody a lot of time, up or down.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Anthony Rodriguez of the United States. Your Honor, this is a case at its core where it appears that we have an ineffective assistance of counsel claim masquerading as a motion to withdraw a guilty plea. I was prepared today to reiterate the Carr factors that I prepared in my brief, but given the court's attentiveness to specific components of it, I will save the court's time, and I will stand on my brief and with respect to the actual innocence claim as to whether the government suffered prejudice. I will note on the extent of delay question that Your Honors were asked, I think the important note is that this was approximately 11 months. And this court in previous cases has held as short as 69 days was undue delay, as this court indicated in it was Renard, and 3 months was undue in Brewster. And so I think the amount of time in this case far exceeds what this court has already held as an undue delay.
Well, speaking of delays, I noticed that he pled guilty in March of 2019, and the pre-sentence report was prepared in June of 2019.
Yeah, my understanding on that, Judge Higginbotham, was that there was a series of unopposed continuances that were mutually granted that led to that. One of the common threads, I believe, in this case is the lack of evidentiary development. I can't exactly provide the answer as to what caused that, but only that it did appear that it was on the basis of a mutual agreement, Your Honor. And as to the inconvenience and judicial resources, again, not raised, I'll stand on brief. As to the close assistance prong, which is what I think is, in essence, going to be central to this discussion, in United States against Struthers, which I believe Judge Higginbotham, in writing for the court, the opinion stated that close assistance is a distinct inquiry from ineffective assistance. And in order to be, or to satisfy that component, the counsel must be, one, available to the defendant, and two, if the defendant expresses his satisfaction with the representation that he received, an individual cannot prevail on that factor. And what we have here in this case, Your Honor, is on the record from the Rule 11 colloquy on record 163, the court will, Your Honors, will see that Mr. Gardner did in fact express satisfaction with counsel.
But at that point, counsel, he was told, I guess, that you could file your motion to suppress after you plead guilty. How was he to know that that was, I mean, how is he as a layperson, non-lawyer, to know that that's incorrect as a matter of law? In other words, if he was operating under a misimpression, can we excuse his statements under oath during the colloquy?
Well, Your Honor, I think the problem with the statements that we've heard with what Mr. Gardner's position was is there hasn't been a hearing or anything to develop that. That claim was, none of those claims were made in the court below. And so what we're going off of is, as Your Honor requested, was there an affidavit? No, there was not. There was nothing filed to substantiate further. And so I think if, I would say it's premature, Judge Wilson, to answer that question, because we don't know for certain that this, in fact, alleged course of events took place as they have been represented to the court.
Well, if it's premature, don't we then have to send it back for a hearing?
No, Your Honor, because I think the statements that the defendant made, although I understand that the question being if he's operating under a misconception, I believe the Rule 11 colloquy was so thorough, and in specific, there was a defendant who came, as my friend noted in his brief, there were a number of individuals present at that Rule 11. This was not an individual. Mr. Garner got called in, and he was individually before the court. There was, I believe, five other people. And one of the defendants, when asked a question about his counsel and whether he was satisfied, he gave what in the record says is an indiscernible response. So I don't even know what he said to the magistrate judge, but I do know that the magistrate judge's response was, well, hold on now. If you're not satisfied or if you don't understand what's going on, I'm gonna give you time, go talk to your attorney. I do know that the next defendant to be before the judge was Mr. Garner. So Mr. Garner was there to watch that happen, where there was something that didn't flow as it normally would have during the course of a Rule 11, and the judge paused, did not allow that individual to go forward until he was certain that he was ready to proceed.
That still doesn't seem responsive to Judge Wilson's query, because if the person doesn't know there's a problem, they don't know what they don't know. So I get your point that he had seen somebody who wasn't ready to fully go and knew, quote unquote, that that could happen. But to the question Judge Wilson, if you're thinking everything's hunky-dory based on what your lawyer says, I mean, that doesn't really help you. I mean, I get your argument, but it doesn't really help you if you don't know what you don't know.
I understand.
Or
that, Judge.
You're saying I'm satisfied with counsel because I'm thinking, well, what he said is okay.
Anyway. Well, the I guess what's responsive to that is during the Rule 11, the magistrate judge specifically asked whether he'd went over any defenses with the accused, and his answer was again in the affirmative that there was no issue raised. And so while I understand that there is an obvious disparity between counsel and the accused, I mean, I think the Rule 11 colloquy as provided was extremely comprehensive, again, as evidenced by the fact that there was a pause. But I think that the assertions that we're hearing here are standing in contradiction to what happened at the Rule 11.
One of the things we're inquiring as to whether or not he understood the plea and the consequences, et cetera. And he's sitting there, but he says, with a misapprehension, that I'm pleading guilty, but we're going to have a hearing on motion to suppress. I don't think that, it doesn't strike me that the colloquy here solves the problem. I mean, it's adequate. I assume it's full, and I'm sure I'm confident it was. I haven't read it, but that's just the basic.
Well, I believe as this court wrote in the United States against McKnight, when addressing an ineffective assistance claim, this court had held that the motion to withdraw a guilty plea was not the appropriate place to flesh that out, but rather in post-litigation proceedings akin to a 2255. In fact, I believe, Judge Stewart, I think that was your opinion in McKnight, where that was the court's position. And I guess the issue in coming to this is, while I understand there are assertions of a lack of understanding, it just doesn't appear to me that those are sufficiently borne out. And what I do understand is that in as much as we're contemplating the sixth factor, which my friend stated was the single most important, it asks whether the plea was knowing and voluntarily given, which, as this court is no doubt aware, requires a two-part inquiry where the court looks to whether the individual understood the consequences of pleading guilty and that whether they had entered into that plea free of intimidation. And when an individual at that proceeding states under oath that neither of those two conditions exist, that he did know what the penalties were, after the magistrate judge read the maximum penalties he was to face and asked him specifically whether anybody had threatened him to get him to plead guilty, there's a presumption that's created that the plea that was given is in fact valid.
And that's it's a presumption, but if he's traveling under a misimpression about what his rights and remedies are, particularly to a motion to suppress, back to the original point, what good does the plea colloquy do? I mean, I know we give great weight to statements under oath in court. I think that's very important. I think it's also very important for them not to come back after the fact and say, well, no, I just kind of rethought it. I didn't mean what I said. But that doesn't seem to be what's going on here.
Well, I would try to say back to you in that respect, Judge Wilson, is that the issue with allowing this case to... Okay, so I can conceive a scenario where there is some affidavit, there's some evidentiary support to substantiate this, where that we would be on a different footing than where we are at this juncture, because there would be something to substantiate it. And I'm not saying that what Mr. Gardner is alleging is not true, but the reality is it is
an affidavit by whom?
I mean, Your Honor, if we have one from counsel stating if there was something where Mr. Gardner had even written something down as to what his grievance was, I mean, there's a number of times in cases that I deal with back in El Paso where defendants will handwrite letters to judges that become part of the record, that would at least be some evidence with which to direct the court to as to the validity of the claim. The problem we have is this came 11 months after he had already pleaded guilty, and I'm not going to stand here and make an accusation, but that's a substantial amount of time to make what is on its face a very direct claim. To me, it seems curious that it took that long for this to come into existence. And I think the problem with allowing this case to procedurally move and the court to contemplate a remand is it's no different than what the analysis on the first prong, the actual innocence. And as the court had noted, it would essentially invite automatic that right to anyone who post hoc after their plea decides to say, well, my counsel was ineffective and I believe you should let me withdraw without any support at all whatsoever. And I think that's the challenge that this court will encounter in embarking down that road on these facts. Now, there, as I said, I'm not going to say that this is a never scenario. It's certainly not, because I understand the concerns that you've expressed, Judge Stewart, with the comparative lack of understanding, and I don't think it would be fair for this court or any court to expect the criminally accused to know every single, you know, a rule that would apply to them. But that's where the magistrate judge comes in, is to attempt to explain the rights as they need to understand them before they can plead, knowing in this case that there was a 240-month mandatory minimum that he was facing. And so while I understand Judge Higginbotham's concerns that the Rule 11 may not have fully addressed, that's the mechanism that is in place to attempt to prevent issues just like this from occurring. And so I think that the issue is then, in light of all of the Carr factors, has Mr. Gardner proved that there is a just and adequate reason? And I don't think on this record he has. Because the only factor that I believe can weigh in his favor would be the government prejudice prong. I mean, given that the time from when the order came to the district court, it was a day when he granted it. So I think I don't want to stand here and make the general arguments of, you know, memory and things that you would see in any other brief, because again, Your Honors have seen those a million times. I don't think that there's a distinct prejudice that the United States is prepared to point to in this case. However, as this court noted in McKnight, the second prong is insufficient by itself to justify the relief that's sought in this case. And I believe that the prongs that do stand a little higher, I understand that there's no factor or combination of factors that can produce a result, but it certainly seems that the inconvenience prongs tend to yield to close assistance and the knowing involuntariness of the plea as it came in. And I don't believe, given that the record makes quite clear that Mr. Gardner did in fact have the chance to array any concerns he had, one, not only because he was asked, but again, because he watched another individual do that. Now, I do understand that Mr. Gardner, this was certainly not his first time before the court, but I don't want to put that against him in a sense that should in fact make him some sort of an expert. Again, I believe that would be extremely unfair. But it is different in the Rule 11 in that he was right there when he saw all he needed to do if he wanted to raise and how the court would treat it. He wasn't going to be scolded. He was going to be given every opportunity. In fact, the judge went as far as to say, I want you to explain now. I don't want to wait, want you to wait until you receive a sentence that you don't like or some outcome that you don't agree with to bring this, to bring a claim that you want to withdraw. And so I think that that is what makes this case distinct in the run of cases, and I believe is an important factor for the court to bear in mind when moving forward and analyzing the totality of this as Carr does require in determining whether Mr. Garner's guilty plea or his request of withdrawal should be granted.
So beyond the government's other arguments, you feel like the 11 months would make this an outlier in and of itself?
I don't think the 11 months does it in and of itself. I believe that Mr. Garner can also not make the close assistance argument given that he had counsel there and he stated.
I wasn't limiting your argument to that. I was just saying, you know, you pressed hard to say, you know, if we've said 39 days or whatever it is, my takeaway from that point is you're saying, putting other things aside, the 11 months would make it an outlier in that sense.
I agree, and I believe so,
I'm
because
just saying that's in essence what you're saying. Right?
I think so, Your Honor, because I believe that there are probably, I don't want to suggest that I counted, but I'm certain that there are a number of cases where the Rule 11 went and the individuals admitted that they understood what the penalty was and that nobody induced them. So I don't think that's a distinct one. So I think if I had to pick one of the factors, I believe it's likely the delay or the close assistance argument that doesn't cut in favor of Mr. Garner as well. I think those are the two strongest. I would also note that the second issue in this case does indicate that the second question is whether the district court erred in refusing to hold the evidentiary hearing. Well, in this context, the two questions are interlinked. If the defendant can make the Carr factors, then it appears it is an error if the district court did not hold the hearing. But if the contrary is true and that there was no support under Carr, well, then it is not an error to refuse to hold the evidentiary hearing. And so the United States position, unsurprisingly, is that the district court did not err in denying the motion to withdraw or for refusing to hold the evidentiary hearing, because in absence of the Carr factors, this court has said that, and I believe it was the United States against Powell, that a district court is not required to hold the evidentiary hearing when the Carr factors are unmet. And as I had mentioned with the remaining issues that are not addressed, I believe to look to the questions that were presented to my friend, I believe during the course of our discussions, Your Honor, I've also swept all of those up. And if the court has no other questions, I would yield back the remainder of my time, but I would like to ask this court, the United States respectfully requests this court to affirm the decision of the district court in this case. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, sir. All right. We're back to you, Mr. Young, for rebuttal.
Yes, sir. I have three matters I'd like to briefly mention, Your Honor. One is regarding the delay issue. Again, it was approximately 12 months, just under 12 months delay from the time of the plea of guilty until the motion to withdraw the plea of guilty was filed. Again, the first 5 months, the retained attorney was still on the case and didn't do anything. Long history of inadequate performance. Secondly, I remind the court that there is one case that this court has decided that is exactly on point with our facts, and that's the McDonald case. And in that case, this court excused a 9-month delay, where we would have a 7-month delay in our case after the new attorney takes over. Secondly, Mr. Rodriguez distinguished between close assistance of counsel, which is one of the 7 Carr factors. Has the defendant received close assistance? That's different from ineffective assistance, and that is correct. Mr. Gardner's retained attorney failed on both points. He did not provide close assistance as to repeatedly turning up at rearrangement with a proposed plea bargain agreement that he has not discussed and not been out to the jail to talk to the client about. He also fails on the ineffective assistance wing. And if ineffective assistance becomes important in the Carr factors, it comes into the 6th Carr factor of making the plea involuntary. So in this case, the retained attorney did not provide close assistance, he was negligent, distant, unavailable. And secondly, he also committed ineffective assistance, which led to the involuntary plea. On the car factors, Your Honor, the seven car factors listed that the court is to use in deciding whether to allow a plea of guilty to be withdrawn, we believe that Mr. Gardner wins on six of those. The one that cuts against him is the delay. But again, in the McDonald case, this court found that the involuntary plea was so important, and because it waives constitutional rights, that it overcame a nine-month delay. And so finally, Your Honor, I'll simply say I found one case where this court found that a district court had abused its discretion in refusing to permit a defendant to withdraw his plea. That's the McDonald case, and it is exactly on point with our case factually.
Yeah, let me clarify one confusion in my mind about the timeline. He pleads guilty March 2019, and the initial pre-sentence report, was prepared in June 2019. At that time, if you explain that by motion, I don't understand how he pleads guilty and then asks for delays in the presentation of the pre-sentence report. Normally what happens is they plead guilty and then, of course, the pre-sentence process goes forward. But that's a substantial delay in coming forward with a pre-sentence report. I didn't know if that's attributable to his request or not.
Your Honor, the typical procedure in the Waco Division of the Western District is a defendant pleads guilty. About 2 months later, the pre-sentence report is ready, and sentencing occurs within 2 weeks or so, about 2 weeks after that. Well, I don't know why there would be such a long delay.
Well, it was from March of 2019 to June of 2019. So my point, I'm just trying to get the delay, delay weighing against him for the time that he took. And if it is, I would know if, on the other hand, it takes that many months to even prepare a pre-sentence report. I'm not a stranger to this, of course. I've arraigned a lot of people, and I don't ever recall a pre-sentence report being that late, taking that long. Of course, I was in Dallas, not in the Northern District, not in the Western District.
Yes, sir. Seems I do remember at some point, Your Honor, I don't know if it was shortage of staff in the probation office, but it seemed like there was a period when pre-sentence reports were taking a little longer than...
I'm not complaining of the delay, because I'm confident that it was unavoidable, but the question is whether that time is chargeable to him or to the government.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Thank you.
All right. Anything further, counsel?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
All right, as I always like to say and need to say, your CJA counsel, and I couldn't underscore enough the value of you and all others similarly situated for handling the many cases that you get under, difficult to put it mildly, circumstances here, the pandemic and all that sort of stuff. So on behalf of the panel and the Fifth Circuit as a whole, we thank you for your service and others.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Rodriguez, for a good briefing and good argument and responsiveness to the court's questions. Case will be submitted and we'll figure it out. All right. Thank you. All right. Next case, 20-50994, Lindsay versus United States.